Welcome to the Dream Journal. From the studios of KSQD in Santa Cruz, the Dream Journal is a weekly show where we explore the power of nighttime dreams through conversations with dream experts and with listeners like you. The life you find is something understood. So there's now those vital minutes. Time is keenly found. A dream can be meaningful even if you don't know what it means. Today's music is called Extracorporeal. Thank you, Rick Level. How does a near-death experience affect your life's path? Hear one man's story about how death before death can be a spiritual rebirth. So too, in dreams, death can be a gateway to awakening. Our guest today is Narakara Vani of the Philosophical Entertainment Podcast. I am your host, Catherine Bell of Experiential Dreamwork, and welcome to the Dream Journal. We'll be taking call-ins during the last 30 minutes of the show. You can also email us anytime at onair@ksqd.org. There's still a few tickets left for our Festival of Dreams, a conference at the Santa Cruz Museum of Art and History, October 10th through 12th. A chance to meet local dreamers and find community around dreams. Our keynote address will be by Dr. Apila Colorado and is called Embody the Multiverse of Your Dreams, an Indigenous Circle Calls. Go to festivalofdreams.net for schedule, lodging, info, and tickets. Hope to see you there. Okay, let me say hello to our guest, Narakara Vani. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Good. And am I going to call you Vani? Is that what you like?
Yeah, people just call me Vani.
Vani. Okay. Thank you so much. Well, I wonder if you would like to introduce yourself.
So my name is Vani. In the world of forms, I was known as Matthew Mansfield, a math tutor, a technologist. But in awakening, that identity dissolved. Now, as Vani, I serve as a spiritual tutor, offering the same aha moments, but for the soul. So I host Philosophical Entertainment, and I founded Antara Pathways, a nonprofit for spiritual end-of-life care. Hmm. So my work now is to help others remember that this life is a dream and gently guide them back to the dreamer.
Mm. Love that. Thank you so much, Vani. So I wonder, why don't you start with the story of your near-death experience, if that seems right to you? That's what I'm curious about. And I think our listeners would love to hear that story.
Yeah, that's a...
Right?
Yeah, that's an interesting place, right? Let me just... back my mind up here.
So, of course. Well, you're welcome to go in a different direction if you had something.
No, this is great. That does seem to be the thing a lot of people are curious
right.
about.
Sure.
Years ago, a while back, I was a police officer, and I had... because this is live, there's no bleeping or anything, so I'm not going to include any names or anything.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. So while I was a police officer, I stumbled upon some corruption in the department that I was working at. And it's interesting how when you don't have a spiritual guru in your life, the patterns of life itself become your guru, if only you choose to take upon yourself the position of student. And this really curious pattern kept presenting itself in my life, and I wasn't paying attention to it. And if you don't pay attention to things in class, you're going to repeat the class.
True.
So I kept repeating this class over and over again until it finally hit me. And so what happened was I was serving as a police officer, and I don't want to go into the nature of the corruption, But it was pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
And so myself and seven other police officers at the department filed a class action lawsuit against our department. And in my particular claims as the plaintiff, I had named my chief of police and the department. Separate from that, as you know, the nature of things goes,
right.
If you don't learn the lesson, it just keeps getting more intense. I was also representing myself in court pro per against my soon-to-be ex-wife at the time. So I was handling a divorce case in court. Additionally, I had to file another lawsuit against another police sergeant at the department, and I was pro per in that case. And then we had an attorney for our main case, for me and the seven other officers. We had an attorney, but our attorney made mistakes in our initial filing. So the way that things were going, we would have been liable for certain financial things in the case if we didn't let go of our attorney. So we let go of our attorney, and then each of the plaintiffs were pro per at that point.
I'm sorry, does that mean, pro per?
It's Latin. It just means for oneself. So I was representing myself.
I see.
Apologize. Yeah.
No, thank you.
And so I was representing myself now in this case against the police department, against this police sergeant. I was representing myself in family court. And then our case went from state court. It was escalated to federal court. And I don't know if you've ever represented yourself in court, but the learning curve is pretty steep.
Okay.
Which is why attorneys go through school.
Well, yeah.
And so I was trying to keep up with everything, and it was pretty intense. So I was working full-time at night as a police officer, and then I was also working full-time during the day as a software engineer. And I blew through every bit of money that I had, lost everything. So I'm living in my car, working two jobs, representing myself in all of these court cases. And the particular case in federal court, it was going to discovery, and I was trying to get this thing to go to trial so that I would have witnesses on the stand that could actually see the evidence. And, you know, some things were happening while I was an officer, and one call for service, I got hit by a car in a traffic stop. And then and these other things, I had called out for backup and nobody would come to help me because word got out that I was suing the chief, which meant I had crossed the blue line.
Ooh.
And
yeah.
So I was blackballed.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had the records because I was an officer and I could access all the records. So I had the records that would incriminate them. But I couldn't just give that over to the court because that would violate the chain of custody. So in order for you to have documents to submit to court, you have to go through the proper channels, which means I would have to do a records request to get the same records that I already had. Otherwise, they could cry foul, right? And so I would place a records request and they wouldn't honor it. Then I would, you know, it's very frustrating. Like, why? Obviously, they don't want to release the Epstein files, right? They don't want to release anything that could incriminate themselves. So then I would go to the court and I would get a subpoena, get the judge to sign it. And I go down and I give them the subpoena. Well, there's a caveat in the law that says that the police departments don't have to release records so long as the case is under active police investigation. So any request that I placed, they would immediately put that case under active police investigation. So then they didn't have to release the records. So I was stuck because they wouldn't incriminate themselves. They wouldn't release anything that made them look bad. And that was the pattern that kept repeating itself until I woke up. So the way that I woke up, the way it happened was, you know, obviously court cases don't go like a 30-minute television show. Like, this is going on for years. And so I asked myself, every day for a year, I was pondering this concept. And it finally, in the way that a master or a guru would issue a logic puzzle called a koan to a student, this was my koan. This was the logic puzzle that I had to fall into in order to wake up. And so say if you're, like, I was a 911 operator for over 10 years before I became a police officer. And if you take a radio, so it deals a lot with broadcasting and that. So if you take two microphones or two radios together and you key them both up, so they're both transmitting, and you start bringing them closer and closer and closer to each other, it generates a paradox called heterodyne. And it's essentially a thing trying to define itself. So a thing can't broadcast, receive, and broadcast itself. It's a paradox. So if that's like, oh, that's kind of confusing. Well, say you're a word nerd. A word cannot define itself. In Latin, it's called a definium and a definiendum. That's the term, and then the term's defining the term. And so if I were to define the word tomato in the definition, I can't say it's a tomato because it references back to itself. It creates a paradox. It doesn't explain anything. And then it's like, okay, well, maybe you're more legally minded, which was me in this lawsuit. Here's the logic trap for me, the logic puzzle. I was the victim. I was also the attorney. And because nobody would respond to me, I would also then have to be the witness. But a thing can't define itself. So if I am allegedly a criminal, right? I'm being accused of some kind of crime. I can't go on the stand and have somebody say, oh, did you do this crime? And I say, nope. And they say, okay, thank you. You're free to go. That's a tomato defining tomato. So it requires an outside reference. So I need witnesses. I need that the documentation. And so this is what I was asking myself every day for a year. How can a man testify of his own innocence? And so in court, they won't let that take place. In the dictionary, they won't allow a word to define itself.
Right, right.
On the radio, radios can't define themselves. And so my mind fell into this, and I started to see how this logic applies in this particular reality that we occupy. A thing can't define itself.
Right.
So then I thought, now wait a minute. Now, if I got a police officer to testify of the innocence of another police officer, aren't we both tomatoes? Aren't we both police officers? So how can a thing define a thing if it's the same thing? And then I kind of zoomed out and I thought, well, what if he's my neighbor? How can a neighbor define another neighbor in the same neighborhood? And I kept zooming out, a citizen, a human, an occupant of Earth. And then I asked myself, wait a minute, where does the universe exist? Because in order to define where the universe exists, you have to have an outside reference. But the moment you find an outside reference, that outside reference becomes part of the known universe. So you're right back in the beginning again. So nothing in the universe can say where the universe exists. And as I fell into this, I realized, now wait a minute. If no one can say where this is, it's nowhere. This isn't happening. This isn't real.
Well, just because something can't be defined doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And I'm just kind of wondering, is this relating to your near-death experience? I thought,
so it was
I'm a little lost.
Yeah, it was in this experience that I left my body.
Okay.
Because I realized that this was a dream. And so I woke up from the dream and began vividly dreaming. So in the same way, if you're in a dream, because a dream that we experience here in this reality is nothing more than like a cashier reconciling their till. It's like unfinished business. It's an echo of the subconscious in the way that you can reverse engineer somebody's entire life by reading their palm or by reading their foot. It's just a way of analyzing what it is. And then it tells you if you're in balance or if you're out of balance. In the same way, you can tell if your register is in balance or out of balance at the end of the day by analyzing the residual. And if you're in a dream from this reality, you go to sleep and you have a dream. If in the dream, you ask yourself, where is this happening? You realize that in the same way, like when you went to sleep last night, I didn't dream some of those characters for you. Only one person can have a hallucination. And when you come to the realization that no one can say in the dream where it is, you wake up from the dream because you come to the conclusion that there's a dreamer that's having the hallucination. And so in my experience, I became the dreamed and the dreamer simultaneously and had the full near-death experience, which I can
wait,
go
wait,
into.
Wait. You're saying your near-death experience was in a dream? I thought I heard you sent me an audio about, I thought I heard something about almost drowning in a pool.
So that, yes, so
okay.
That did happen as well. Yeah, I did drown as a child. Yes, that did happen. Then my mother revived me, yes. But the near-death experience that I had from this reality came in the process of that particular lawsuit. And then I can go into...
So wait, the lawsuit, was it part of the dream or not? See, I'm really lost, honey. I'm totally lost. I don't get it. Were you actually a police officer? Or is it all part of the dream?
It's all in this life, yes. I was a police officer.
Okay. Yeah. So what part was the dream? I guess help me out here.
So I awoke from this reality is what I'm saying. So I was a police officer and I was in the course of this lawsuit when I woke up. Mm-hmm. Or when I had my near-death experience. So it was as we were going to discovery when I had my near-death experience.
In the dream.
In this reality.
In this reality? So what actually happened? I don't understand what happened.
So in this reality, you can wake up from this reality. And when you do, in the same way you can't be a virgin porn star, you have to give something to get something. Mm-hmm. In order to wake up from this reality, you have to surrender your ego. So after I had my near-death experience, you know, obviously I had to close out the lawsuit and all this other stuff had to carry on. And I was trying to put words to the experience of leaving my body and seeing myself outside of myself and traveling, you know, through time and universe and whatever. And so I became a yoga instructor. The near-death experience that I had taught me a lot about the body and about attachment and about how things in this place work. And so I have taken a lot of time to work out a lot of the attachments that I had, to decompress from being a police officer, to come down from the ego identity of being called Matthew. And that's where, when I'm working in this sort of space, I go by Nirakara Vani, which is Sanskrit. It means formless voice. And so when I'm teaching yoga or, you know, working with my yogis and that, we're doing breathing exercises and meditation and that, they just call me Vani. Everybody in those kind of circles, they just know me as Vani. And so I've done a lot of work in how this reality works and how we've attached ourselves to it. And so in the same way, like when I worked in the math tutoring center, you know, I'd have a different student come in and they'd always be angry, you know, frustrated. And I would work with them because I understood that the mind can't operate in a dual state. You can't be angry and take a math test. And a lot of people would come in and they'd say, you know, I'm not a therapist, solve your own problems, math. And so we would have this kind of like decompression time where we get over the attachment of failing an exam, maybe, or getting bad grades on their homework. And once we got through the emotions, then we can start to math together. And I would work with helping people see the puzzle of a quadratic equation. And I can't have the aha moment for them, but I can certainly guide them to it. And I could be there when they have it. And in that same way, I provide that experience for people spiritually, where I can't have a spiritual aha moment for them, but I can certainly kind of read where they're at and guide them to that aha moment.
So what about that step that you mentioned about overcoming the emotional situation? Because humans are extremely emotional, and you know that's... Most of us are emotional all the time. And so what do you mean? I mean, you said that very lightly, but what do you do about that?
When we're having feelings, there's a lot of interesting kind of things that are going on with that. And, you know, as part of my sort of decompression from being a police officer, I also joined an improv theater, and I took a lot of improv classes, and I became a performer, actor, improv, comedian, whatever. And our team was called the Haven Dasselhoffs. And there's a lot of rules of comedy. And it's interesting how they also mirror a lot of the rules of yoga. And it's like when you're rocking a baby, there's a kind of mental space you get into in that rocking. There's not really a whole lot to think about. There's not really a whole lot to do. You're just rocking the baby. You fall into this liminal state. And it's sort of this space without words. And, you know, I've worked in business and things like that. And as an administrator in business, you're trying to set up flow. You're trying to set up a work flow for your employees so that they can fall into liminal state and just do the work. And when we would work with math, it's the same thing. Or when I'm working with yogis, it's the same thing. When people present, like in the yoga studio or in the tutoring center, they don't realize that, and especially in yoga, it teaches that we carry a lot of the baggage of our life in our bodies physically. And when your chakras aren't aligned, they're kind of like an antenna, and you can kind of crank your antenna in response to crisis and trauma. And so when people come in, I can just observe their body and kind of see which chakra is out of alignment. And I know that they're holding something in there. And when you're holding on to something, like you're upset about failing a math test, you need to wring that out a little bit and you need to express something. And so with yoga, I help people move their bodies physically to wring out those attachments. And so that's how you can store trauma in the body. So when you present on the scene, you know, in the words of William Shakespeare, life is but a stage and we're all, you know, players or actors upon it. When you present on stage, you might not realize that the scene didn't include your baggage. You carried that with you. And so you're respawning your upset. And some people are not doing it intentionally. It's coming in their bodies. And then other people, they're holding on to it in their minds. Perhaps their chakras might be aligned, but their mind is still attached. And so with that, I do breath work and meditation to help their mind get wrung out and to let go of the trauma that they're holding on to.
Well,
so that's what I would do.
Okay. That's okay.
Let go of those emotions.
Right. So there's all the physical, because, you know, I'm finding that I'm having like a lot of feelings myself right now.
Okay. Let's go into that.
Yeah. Because this is not at all what I was expecting to be talking about. Like, I thought we would start out with some stories about your life and like your near-death experience, which is at the top of your bio. So I expected you would be ready to talk about that. And instead, we've gone on into this much more philosophical, abstract conversation. And I'm having a hard time connecting to you. And I'd really like to be more connected to you.
Let's connect, girl.
Okay.
Do it.
Okay. Well, like, what? So where, like you say, you just see people's chakras when they walk in the room. That's kind of woo-woo. I mean, I just going to say, I mean, I'm a dream person. And yet there's something like that's also seems a little disrespectful. Like, people share what they want to share, and maybe they're not ready to share that particular block with you at the moment. And so I like took a risk by speaking up right now to say that I'm feeling kind of stuck.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. So in the way that, so for like years and years, for over 17 years, I'm in law enforcement and I'm trained, and I was working at a bouncer at clubs and things like this. And I was trained to observe bodies for threats.
Right.
And nobody says anything when they're performing physical actions, body language, but it's saying something. And so whether they do or don't want me to understand that they're threatening in some way, it can be unspoken, and that's okay. And so in the way I see people's chakras, it's not like I see light or energy or anything like that. I see the way they're holding themselves in the way I could see if a guy, so in law enforcement, it's called the 90. You watch somebody's 90, which is 90% of all weapons are carried in the waistband. Eyes can't shoot you, so you don't need to look at their eyes. You just need to look at their mannerisms, and are they in any way blocking their 90? And if they are, there's more than likely a weapon in there. So in the way that I say I see people's chakras, I could see if somebody's approaching that is threatening, because I can see how they're holding their hips. There's probably a gun there because there's weight. He's counterbalancing his body to compensate for the weight of the weapon and so on. So when I was working security, I would watch people for threats in that way. Mm-hmm. So if I saw a possible suspect approaching, I would understand, okay, he's got a weapon on his left side or whatever, whatever. And so when I see somebody entering into the yoga studio, now I'm kind of in a different mind space. So I'm not observing people for threats. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of threats in yoga pants. But what I am seeing is how they're holding their physical body? Are their shoulders slumped forward? That's their heart chakra. Are their hips tipped backwards? They're holding on to possibly sexual trauma or some kind of trauma. And so when I'm seeing their chakras misaligned, what I'm seeing is a back is out of alignment. Their hips aren't lined up properly. And so that's what I'm observing. And I can see, oh, okay, today needs to be more of a Hatha flow day. And we need to focus on the psoas and we need to do more hip movements. And so there's going to be like a lot of pigeon and this kind of thing. So I understand like what positions we're going to be moving into that day. So that's what I'm saying when I can see people's chakras misaligned. I'm seeing bodies that aren't standing properly.
Well, then the radio must drive you nuts because you can't see my body position at all.
That's true.
Right?
Yes.
And you check my 90 and I'll say that I'm really want to hear about your drowning experience.
Yeah. Okay.
Are you tired of talking about it? I mean, maybe you're kind of avoiding it. You kind of drop this little bomb here. Like, oh, I almost drowned and my mother. What?
So that's, yes, that's kind of experience, you know, and so you're talking about, so I did an interview where I very, very briefly kind of went into some things. So when I was, when I was young, I was a child and I didn't know how to swim and I didn't know how to speak or anything. I was a toddler. I was playing around the pool and I fell into the pool and my mother pulled me out and resuscitated me. And so when I go into that experience in that particular interview that you were referring to, I know that I talked about the light that came to me from the bottom of the pool. And it wasn't it wasn't like a flashlight or like a light bulb. It was like radiation. And in the way like when you're reading a book, you can become distracted or attached to the black letters that are running along the lines of the page. And when you're focused on the narrative of the story, you fail to ask yourself, well, what is this hosted on? And when you're reading a book, the black letters are hosted on a white page. And when you go to look at the white page, you have to let go of the black letters. The black letters become a little fuzzy, and then you can tune into or visually see the white page, but you can't see them both simultaneously. And in this sort of space in the pool, the black letters of my life faded away, and I saw what everything was hosted on. So in the white light coming to me at the bottom of the pool, mm-hmm. what I was seeing was the page. And the page is love. And I became surrounded by this radiation, and I stopped seeing the story of my life, and all I saw was the page, the void. And the light isn't like we see light. It was moving. It was like jellyfish in water. It was floating pattern that surrounded me. And it was absolute peace. There was nothing else I wanted more than just to remain in that. And I know that, you know, I in the interview that I think you're referring to, then my mother pulls me out. She pulls me out of the radiation and back into the black letters of my life and away from the page that it's all hosted on. And I was too young at the time to really index the memory of that. And it wasn't until I went to that retreat in Mexico where I did some regressive therapy with an indigenous spiritual leader there and everything that they uncovered this memory. Mm-hmm. And I remembered it so vividly. And interestingly enough, after that experience, I didn't remember the drowning. I didn't remember all of that. But what I did remember was how resentful I was toward my mother for pulling me out of love and back into the story. And so ever since that time, I carried resentment toward my mother, and I could never explain why I resented her so much until I had that experience where I could regressively go back and remember that. So
that pattern probably lived in your life until you were able to bring it to consciousness of resentment.
Yeah.
And like why am I here? Why am I alive?
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. Thank you, Bonnie. Thank you. This feels like This is the point. This is what we're here for.
Yeah, I'm an open book. So anything that you're interested in. But yeah, so in the same way like your show, if somebody were to ask, what is this hosted on? You could go into what it's hosted on. But in order to do that, you kind of have to stop listening to the show. And in the same way, you know, like I have websites and stuff, they're hosted on something. And a lot of us aren't asking what this is hosted on, which is, you know, trying to say, where does the universe exist? Where is this? And so in my experience as a child, obviously it ties into the near-death experience that I had when I was grown up doing the law enforcement thing. It's all contiguous. It's the same thing. It was the same moment as a grown-up when I let go of the narrative of my life and I fell back into the pool. Mm-hmm. And I was back where I was when I was a child, mm-hmm. back into the void, which is where all of this is hosted on.
Yes. So then we're at to the point of like, how do we live with the letters on the page once, even after we're aware of the page as such? And let's get to that. We need to take a short programmatic break. Think about the radio, because we have the schedule. We have hosts. We are hosted here. So we're going to take a short break, and we'll come right back. And I want to hear more about how you've incorporated this idea of living in the blank page and the love, and how that has been for you since then. So this is Narakara Vani, and he is the host of the Philosophical Entertainment Podcast. And I'm going to let you know we're broadcast live from the KSQD studios in Santa Cruz, and co-broadcast live in San Jose by KCXU, and podcast everywhere. Soon we'll be broadcast at KOWS up in Sonoma as well. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Dream Journal, and I am Catherine Bell of Experiential Dream Work. I'd like to send out a special welcome to our far-flung listeners and all over the county, at San Jose, Atherton, Hayward, Concord, Fresno, also in Quebec, Canada, and in Boston, Massachusetts. So glad to have you listening live. So people all over the world are interested in dreams, and I'd love to have you help me nudge the algorithm to spread interest in dreaming. Please follow The Dream Journal on your favorite podcast app, and if consider leaving a rating or review. But most importantly, tell your friends. The mission of the show is to get people talking about dreams. You can also follow me on Facebook and Instagram to find out about upcoming shows and pod drops by following hashtag The Dream Journal and at Experiential Dreamwork, also on LinkedIn. Please contact me if you'd like to be a guest on the show to talk about a new book or to let folks know about your dream-related offerings. Hope you can join us for our local in-person dream conference at the beautiful Santa Cruz Museum of Art and History. Bring a friend and save. The Festival of Dreams is October 10th through 12th. Learn more about it at festivalofdreams.net, and you can get a member discount by following the directions at asdreams.org/regional. So check us out. Okay, today's guest is Narakara Vani, and we are talking about near-death experiences and the background of a life and how we can come to terms with that. So, Vani, we have a caller on the line. I'd like to say hello to Ellen from Santa Cruz. Hi, Ellen.
Yeah, hi, Catherine.
Hey, thanks for calling.
Oh, my gosh. I had to call in. You hadn't yet opened the phone lines, but it was your break, and I just wanted to believe it. Your guest, Vani, described exactly to a T what my mother used to tell me about an experience she had when she was a young girl. She kept saying she was around 8, but it seems like maybe she was younger. But she also, this was in Wisconsin where she was born and raised as a young kid. And there was a river that was like the community swimming pool area, pool, you know. Mm-hmm. And so they have an area of the river where people would swim and there were the lifeguards. She was a young girl. I guess she didn't know how to swim. And somehow she got in the river there. And she had literally to a T what she would describe. And wow. It made such an impression on her that all her life she would tell us about her near drowning experience, where she somehow slipped in the water and got too far in and started finding herself going down, 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 and saw all that white light. She didn't talk about the ripples of the white, but she talked about that she suddenly wasn't afraid, she wasn't struggling, because it was so beautiful, and she was just going to light. And then they say that, you know, the lifeguard, someone got her out of there, and she was on the shore of the river, and they were doing probably CPR. Mm-hmm. And how she felt really angry and frustrated. What? They took me away from this gorgeous light I was going to. So it was just to a T, the exact experience, even it was a drowning experience.
Oh, interesting. And the resentment of being brought back.
And yeah, exactly. The fact that he says that, and I remember my mother kept saying how she was upset taking her away from this gorgeous, because she said she felt so much peace and love, just like he said, like she was going into the peace and love. And then they pulled her out of that.
Well, so I
just had to call in because I was like, yeah, I guess that's what happens. And then my own experience, I don't know if it was a near death or not, but I was given the opportunity to see what I call the infinite eternal light of the universe. Maybe it was a near death. This was via sacred plant medicine. And I definitely went somewhere I'd never, ever gone. I always say I was like multiple dimensions out of this reality, and that I was given this opportunity to go around and see the entire universe. And the whole thing ended, that experience ended when there was this little like crack, and then the crack opened up and it was just infinite eternal light. And I was just like, whoa. And so I know, because I witnessed it, that the universe is infinite eternal light. And maybe it was that I was in this going into death. I don't know. All I know is my friend next to me kind of was like, she got worried that you were laying there still for so long. I was really concerned. And suddenly I came back into my body and, you know, in consciousness. But it was amazing. Mm-hmm. And when I hear science talk about when you go out into space, it gets darker and darker, I'm like, scientists just don't get it. I know the universe is infinite eternal light. I've seen it. I know it. That's what it is. Maybe that light is infinite eternal love. A lot of people, you know, make the analogy of the light to the love.
Right.
But it was beautiful.
Thank you.
Right before my mother died, I got the opportunity to visit her. Literally, I didn't know it was the last week of her life. It's pretty much right after I left. She died in her sleep, and all my family would say, oh, she was just waiting for you to visit, because it was from when I was going to visit. It was about a 3-month wait until I got there on my spring break. And the family was like, yep, she was waiting for you. And it's true, I was mommy's girl. I was very, very close to my mom. But the very, very first thing I told her, the first evening I was there with her, is I reminded her. I had told her on the phone about my experience, and I remember that I reminded her about my experience. I guess I was trying to comfort her, like, remember, it's all going to be good. It's just infinite eternal light, and that's where you're going.
Wow. I wonder if she remembered her own childhood experience.
Oh, yeah. She was not senile in any way, and she never forgot that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks
for sharing that, Ellen. I really appreciate
you
calling.
How wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Reminds me of what they call a unitive experience, or... there's like a term for when people take psychedelics and they get to a point of, I think it's unity consciousness, something like that. Mm-hmm. And it seems like there's multiple ways to get to that place of like, your analogy, Vani, of seeing the page, not just the words on the page.
I love that analogy.
Yeah.
I thought that was such a cool, and I'm a writer and a teacher.
Oh, how wonderful.
I love that analogy.
Okay. And so it seems like we can access the state from many, many different places, the near-death experience, also maybe during psychedelia, maybe during dreams, maybe during even certain moments of stress, or maybe meditation even. Maybe people experience this in all kinds of different ways. And certainly at the moment of death, we assume that would be what I would hope to experience at that moment, for sure.
If you're lucky to be conscious enough.
Right. Well,
both my parents ended up dying in their sleep, which I guess when you're a kid, you always think, oh, I want to die in my sleep. But according to Tibetan Buddhism, it was the opposite. They spend their whole life studying and working on getting prepared for their death. Mm-hmm. And they always want to be very conscious during their death.
Right. And yet when we're dreaming, when we're asleep, there is a certain kind of consciousness that we are having. Like,
well,
we haven't really touched
true.
On. And so they're.
Oh, sure. If my parents died in their sleep, they could have died in amazing dreams.
They may have.
You're right.
I know Alan Watts says that death is 100% safe. And Ram Dass says it's like taking off a tight shoe.
That sounds right to me.
Thank you very much. I really appreciated this discussion. Thank you.
Yeah, Ellen, thank you so much for calling. Take care.
And I'm looking forward to your amazing dream weekend.
Oh, the Festival of Dreams. You're going to be there. Wonderful. I can't wait to see you.
All right. Thank you for putting it on, Karen.
Sure. All right. Bye, Ellen.
Bye-bye.
So yeah, there's something about this that has like a very universal. It gives me some comfort that it is such a universal experience of the light and the love and that that we can let go of the words, and that there are that there is something that's like, what is it that we just said? Death is 100% safe.
Yeah,
like taking off a tight shoe.
Well, it was so interesting. So in my experience, you. It was like Google. When you're not connected to the internet, you don't have the ability to query Google. And in my experience, my body was like a special program that you can write where you can type in a query that you want to ask Google, and the program saves it. Your body saves the query for you. And when you're connected again to source, or you're connected again to that love, all of your queries that you have wondered that have been saved in your program become answered as you connect to source.
Mm-hmm.
And some people call it a life review, but it's essentially anything that you had ever wondered, even before you knew what words were. You know, there's a tension or there's a stress or a pressure and you don't know what that means. That is queried and it's saved. And so all of this in your body is saved. And in a sort of process of of letting go, you have all of these queries answered. And for me, I started at the beginning of my life, and anything that I had ever been curious about became instantaneously known to me in such a complete way that there was no more room for question. And if in the process another question arose, I would fall into that the answer of that as well. And it was interesting because I learned more about myself in that experience and about how humans work than at any other time in any other educational class I'd ever taken, because I was not prone to anger, but I guess I didn't know what my anger was about or when I would feel anger or jealousy. And so it was answered to me. And I didn't understand that anger has a relationship to justice.
Right.
And it has to do with you forming an attachment to an outcome that doesn't manifest. And the resultant state of that is anger. In the same way with jealousy, you're in a relationship with somebody and you see them flirting with somebody else. And if you've fooled yourself into thinking that this person is the object of your love, to see the object of your love leaving you is terrifying, because you feel that you're losing your love. And that is, you know, why it's never good to objectify anyone. But instead, what I realized is that the person, in fact, was the key or the catalyst that unlocked the love that's inside of you.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And when you realize that the love was coming from inside of you, then you can let go of the key and look for another key that unlocks that love, that same love that's inside of you. And so essentially, everything that we experience is in some way related to attachment. You've attached yourself to an outcome. You attached yourself to that person. And so I realized that in the way that you can attach yourself to the letters of the page, or the narrative of a story you're reading, that when you don't care about the story so much, you're not attached to the characters anymore. And so that if you're reading a story and she cheats on him or he cheats on her in the story, if you're not attached to the outcomes of any of that, then you can't get pulled in to any state one way or another.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you're talking about this, Vani, because dreams are a state where I'm often very non-attached. Like, things happen and crazy things can happen and very improbable creatures. And yet I don't think anything strange of it. And so I'm wondering about dreams. Is being in dreams a little bit closer to that state of being in the field as opposed to on the characters?
That's so interesting that you frame it that way. I really like that, because so I the body that I'm in has PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. So with that, if I fall out of liminal state and back into the ego, Matthew, I'm prone to falling into my past and remembering the people that I've seen pass away in front of me and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And when that sort of happens, when you fall into your past, you experience depression. And when I fall into my future, anticipating that my children could pass and this kind of thing, I fall into anxiety. And so I fall out of balance one way or another, and I'm prone to doing that because of a lot of trauma. I know how things can kind of go sideways. And it's interesting how you talk about dreams, because when I have dreams, and this is part of PTSD, I think that they are a way that my body manifests a lack of balance, but I am like hyper attached in my dreams. And my dreams usually have something to do with torture. It's usually like a lack of control. And, you know, so I'll see, you know, my children dismembered or something in front of me, and everything is so real and I'm so attached to it. Mm-hmm. So in, you know, as I'm unconscious dreaming, people who are seeing me dream or hearing me, I'm usually screaming. And so I have these screaming night terrors. And it is a ripple or an echo of my ego feeling a lack of control. And so, like how trauma works, you know, you have an event essentially that's occurring too quickly, mm-hmm. that you cannot control the factors of the scene work. Mm-hmm.
Well, just to say, Vani, that I do often have some pretty horrific nightmares, and yet there's like a sense of a little bit of perspective, like the dream self I don't always see as me. And so maybe that's what allows a little more detachment. But I haven't said that. We have a question here in the studio. So if you're okay to jump over to Max here, he has a question for you, Vani.
Yeah.
Okay. Hi, Vani.
Hi.
I got to say, I've been listening to you this whole hour very intently. What you're saying strikes me as the truth, very much the truth. You're talking about your view of people's chakras at the very beginning. I sort of could relate to that, because I also have been feeling like I can see people and their intent from body language, just general impressions.
Yeah.
And then you've gotten off on this other stuff too. And I'm going like, yes, the imbalances we're suffering from can be very much indicative of the, whatever imbalances and fears we have and hurts we have. But my question is, this page, this big mystery that you have where everything's written on the universe that you're calling love or something, how does perceiving this help you in any way?
So that's a really interesting question. It's like if you've worked in customer service and somebody comes up in there, they're swearing and they're, you know, doing all of this. It's not because of anything that you've done. It's coming out of them. And in a way, they're projecting their dissatisfaction onto you. But it doesn't have anything to do with you. I had been doing a lot of that I guess. And like the saying, hurt people, hurt people. Mm-hmm. In this dream, in this reality that we're in, things here beget themselves. So you plant a seed and it grows after its own kind. You don't plant a tomato plant and then, you know, cantaloupe come out. The tomato plant grows tomato plant, and hate grows more hate, and love grows more love. And when you have an experience like this, it's a really interesting process to contact that seed of love, because it plants it in you so deep that you love yourself so much that it pours out of you, and you want to spread the love in the same way that person in the customer service experience, they're so full of something and it's pouring out of them, and they want to spread it because birds of a feather flock together, or, you know, it's the same sort of concepts. But it's like when you're watching little toddlers and one toddler makes a silly joke, the other one tries to one-up it, you know, and it's just how things go here. And when somebody has this kind of experience and they have that aha experience with love, then my work is done. Because the love's going to start growing in them so much that they're going to want to spread it. So when they go and they have a customer service experience, they're going to be spreading love. And to me, when I had my experience, everywhere that I've gone, everything that I've seen, even bugs, even just humans, dogs, cats, anything, I see myself in it. And because I love myself so much, and I can't help but love everyone else too. And so to me, the change that's happened, or like, what's the difference, or why is it important? It's because this world, when I look around, I see suffering everywhere. So I see misaligned chakras. I see a lot of characters out of balance.
So Max, what comes up for you around that?
I think you're speaking the truth here on the radio. This is great, Vani. Uh-huh. I'm really liking this interview.
Okay. Thank you. It's interesting, but it's a Christmas carol all over again, you know, because here comes Ebenezer, you know. He sees his past, he sees his present, and he sees his future. Mm. And he realizes, oh my God, I don't have to be Ebenezer Scrooge. And when he comes out of the experience, he's kicking the window open. And boy, give me that turkey, the biggest turkey, you know, in the window. You know, and he's everyone's debt is gone, you know. And he's so full of love and gratitude that he is no longer Scrooge. And that's the beautiful story that we all resonate with, is if we could just wake up and realize that we could lay the ego down of whatever Ebenezer Scrooge we're being, and in any moment we can choose to be something else completely.
Wow. So
very good, Yanni.
Yeah.
I gotta say, you're the real deal. Thanks for talking.
Yeah. Thank you, Max. You're wonderful.
So Vani, thank you so much. So you have this philosophical entertainment podcast. How can folks get in touch with you?
There's a contact form on the website.
Okay.
I absolutely love everyone, so I'm happy to talk to anyone about anything they're wondering.
Okay, fabulous. Well, so good to have you on the show. Do you have any final short words of encouragement for our listeners?
Just love without delay.
Sweet. Oh, thank you so much, Vani.
Yeah, thank you. This is wonderful. Catherine, I love you so much. You're just so amazing. I love your show and I listen to it all the time.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
That's so sweet. Well, take care, Vani.
Thank you.
All right. Bye. So thank you all for listening. The Dream Journal is produced at the studios of KSQD in Santa Cruz, and we are live every Saturday at 10 a.m. Pacific at ksqd.org. The podcast is released on the Monday after the show. It spreads interest in dreaming when you subscribe, rate, and review. I am Catherine Bell. You can find out about my dream coaching practice at experientialdreamwork.com. Email me at Catherine@ksqd.org, KATHERINE@ksqd.org. Follow Experiential Dreamwork and hashtag The Dream Journal on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn to keep up with the shows. I'd like to thank Rick Kleffel, engineer and music creator, audio editing by Suki Wessling, and phones by Eric Nelson. Intro and outro pieces are both by Mood Science. Tomorrow morning when you wake up, take a minute to write down your dream and bring it to the next Dream Journal.